This is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks on KQV with expert advice from CPA attorney and retirement and estate planning expert, Jim Lang, the best-selling author of Retire Secure and the Roth Revolution, Pay Taxes Once and Never Again. Now on the air and online worldwide at RetireSecure.com. Get ready to talk smart money.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. I'm David Baer here in the KQV studio with Jim Lang, CPA, attorney, and author of two best-selling books, Retire Secure and The Roth Revolution, Pay Taxes Once and Never Again. There are over 25 million single women over age 45 in the U.S. today. And with women outliving men by almost 5 years, even most married women will someday be solely responsible for their financial futures. What do you need to know? On tonight's Lang Money Hour, we welcome author, speaker, and consultant Jan Cullinane. Jan's books include AARP's The Single Woman's Guide to Retirement and New Retirement, The Ultimate Guide to the Rest of Your Life, which ranked number 2 on both BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon.com. Frequently featured on TV, on the radio, and in many newspapers and magazines, Jan has addressed numerous national companies like Ford Motors, the Smithsonian Institution, and Wells Fargo Advisors. Listeners, since our show is live, Jim and Jan are available to answer your questions. To join the conversation, call the KQV studios at 412-333-9385. Again, that's 412-333-9385. And with that, I'll say hello, Jim, and welcome, Jan.
Welcome, Jan.
Well, thanks. Glad to be on the show.
Well, it's great to have you. I think very highly of your book, and having the AARP endorse it is certainly a great thing. It's the AARP's Single Woman's Guide to Retirement. And
thank you.
And one of the things that you talk about is some of the differences between planning for women, and in particular single women, than for men or married couples. Can you be a little bit more specific in some of the things and some of the different ways that we should think about it, and or some of the specific recommendations that you sometimes give?
Certainly. And as David had said at the beginning, when I talk about single women, I'm referring to the fact of being never married, widowed, or divorced. And as he mentioned, even if you're happily married now, there's an 80 to 90% chance that you will end up being single at some point. So although the book is The Single Woman's Guide to Retirement, if you're a little bit forward-thinking, it probably is going to apply to you if you are female. As he mentioned, the difference in the age and the longevity is an important thing. But if you think about women, and first of all, why is this demographic important? I kind of call it the 5 D's, as it was mentioned, 25 million single women over the age of 45 in the United States. And if we take a look at it, I say it's the 5 D's that are contributing to this growth. So it is a very important demographic. When you think about death of a spouse, for example, and again, because women outlive men by an average of 5 years, when we think of divorce, and that 25% of divorces are between couples over 50, when we think about women delaying marriage, men as well, the average age now is going up. When I think about women in a relationship either dumping the guy or the guy dumping the woman, being either dumped or doing the dumping. And my 50 about the paradigm is sort of changing. A lot of women just do not want to be married. It's not kind of seen in the same high esteem as it used to be, so it's a choice. So when we take a look at that, and then when we combine that with the thought that women are in and out of the workforce much more often than men are. Women are in general, although this is starting to change now, lower paying positions. That women often take on the caregiving duties more so than men. That women earn on average about 81 cents compared to what men make. that women will probably have to work a lot longer because they are living a lot longer. These are all reasons why single women in particular really need to think about retirement even much more carefully than men in a lot of cases.
Well, before we even get to the single women issue, I was very glad to hear you bring up the idea of, let's say, women who are currently married. They really have to do some thinking. And I will tell you some of the pet peeves that I have in practice. This just happened the other day. Guy came in. He had made an election for his pension. He was going to get X dollars per month every month for the rest of his life, or every year, X amount per year, every year for the rest of his life. And then if he died, his wife was only going to get half what he was going to get. And I was thinking, well, all right, if you're going to do that, then what you should do is buy some life insurance, because that way that will make up for the income that you are losing if you die. And he didn't have any life insurance. Then to add, let's say, more bad news, is he decided to take Social Security early. That will forever reduce the benefits that he, and then if he dies, his wife will get. So his wife, potentially, if he dies even relatively early, or even if he makes it until his 70s or beyond, she will not get the full pension. She'll get, let's say, roughly half. And then she'll get a significantly lower amount for her Social Security every month. And let's say she survives him by 5, 10, 15, 20 years. She'll get significantly less every month because of the decision that supposedly they made together, but in reality he made. So I almost wanted to just shake him, and frankly shake her, and say, you can't just blindly listen to him because he's traditionally done the money in the family. This is as important, or probably more important, for you. So I was glad to hear you say that even the singles women issue should be taken into account, even if you're married.
Absolutely. That whole aspect of Social Security, that aspect of pensions, how you're going to take those are very important things. And absolutely all women, whether you are single, and a lot of times single women are in a bit stronger position because they know all the decision-making falls on them. Maybe they'll go and get help from a CPA or from a certified financial planner, from an attorney, but they know that the buck stops with them. Whereas if you are married, you may turn over all of your decision-making to your spouse, and perhaps he is better at it or enjoys it more. A lot of women aren't as interested in money, so they feel somebody there is competent. But certainly, as your example shows, they need to be involved. They need to understand the ramifications. From what you said, it sounds like they discussed it, and she agreed to it, and hopefully she knows what she's actually agreeing to, that the fact she could be living 20 or 30 additional years without those sources of income she could have otherwise had.
Yeah, and it was actually tremendously frustrating to me. In fact, I didn't want to do business with them, because they give me this rap. I always ask people, is the goal to make sure that both the husband and the wife can live comfortably, more or less in the manner in which they are accustomed, for both of rest of their lives? And they usually say yes, and then they pull decisions like this, like one life pensions or small survivor benefits, and then they make an option with regards to Social Security, because by taking Social Security early, let's say you take it at 62 or even 66, you're getting roughly 8% less every year for the rest of your life. But more importantly for our purposes now, let's say for discussion's sake that the husband had the higher earning record, at his death, she will get a lower amount every month for the rest of her life, where if he had waited, which in my opinion would be much more appropriate, or done apply and suspend, then she would get a much higher benefit every year for the rest of her life. So I can't stress enough that women should not just assume that the guy is doing it, because yeah, the guy's knowledgeable somewhat, and yes, he was doing some of the investments with stocks and things like that, and of course a lot of these guys think they know a lot more than they do, but I was kind of there saying, well, here's the flaw in your plan. He dies early. You live a long time. You have half the pension and a reduced Social Security. You're going to have a very hard time living in the manner in which you're used to when you are older. And she's like, well, yeah, but that's kind of what he decided. And I'm thinking, no. So I'm glad that you're on top of the issue of addressing women while they are married to some extent as a single woman's issue.
Absolutely. And the example you give is perfect. And of course, it's also so interesting that here they're going to a professional for advice. The professional is giving them the best advice, but yet even in the face of that, they're still sort of deciding on what they came in and had decided to do, even after hearing the good advice and how they should change it. So it is very complex. It is very interesting, you know, the dynamics between couples, the way that they think about money. It's often hard to project that far into the future. The thinking of your spouse is really not being there. I think some people just think, you know, it's not going to happen to me. It's sort of a wishful thinking thing. But it's a point, like you say, that you see over and over again.
Well, one of the things that I got from your book is that it's okay to be an old single lady, but not an old poor single lady. And you should be doing everything you can when you can do it so that you never end up in that situation. And I applaud you because I think that you are helping people, because my big thing is no matter what happens, you always want food on the table, roof over your head, gas in the car, and a little bit of money for Saturday night. And sometimes if you're not doing some of the things that we are recommending, you might not end up in that position, or you might have a significantly reduced lifestyle in retirement. And I think that really you're right on top of some of these things.
Well, thanks. And I like you use that word sort of lifetime. And I do like that phrase of talking about lifetime planning rather than talking about retirement planning. Again, I think sometimes we sort of discount the future. But if we think sort of lifetime planning, and you were talking about the food on the table and all of that, I always think, you know, holistically, and my books are holistic. I do talk about the money, but I think we need to look in terms of what do we want to do for lifetime planning in terms of wealth, certainly, or money, but also in terms of health, in terms of personal enrichment, in terms of relationships. Perhaps spirituality, if that applies to you, that we need to think holistically, what are our goals in each of those areas and how best are we going to accomplish them? Money certainly does help, and knowing that you're going to not outlive your money is a great way to help fill in all those other blanks in those other areas as well.
Well, to be fair, I usually talk about money on the radio show. But to be fair, your book actually has a lot more than money in it. You're talking about some of the psychological aspects of retirement, such as what are you going to do during your free time? What about travel? What about a part-time job? What about working at home? Then you have a lot of, well, in the guy's phrase, they would call it balls, but you talk about dating and divorce. So it's well beyond a... let's call it a money guide. It's really money and more.
I like that. I like the alliteration there, money and more.
Well, it really is. All right, so let's go back, though. So I think that we are in agreement that when you are married, that a lot of the decisions that are made are really for both members of the couple and not just one. And I really don't like to see people with single life pensions or even just a drastic reduction for the surviving spouse, and unless you're going to, let's say, do life insurance on top of that. But I really don't think that that's a one. And by the way, when you run the numbers, we usually find that you're better off taking a two life rather than a one life and life insurance. So some of these issues, they don't seem like they're really women issues, but they are.
They are, and it's interesting because they found that women often do like to talk with other women about these things as well in smaller kinds of groups. Sometimes I think the man, like you say, the husband, they just feel that he's the expert in this area and they're going to go along with them. Whereas if you get a group of women together in a room, it's very interesting, kind of the topics. It's sort of no holds barred, and you hear things that are very enlightening as well. But to your point, if you are married, absolutely, you need to be looking at how this is going to affect you, because you probably are going to outlive your spouse, and you're 100% right about all of that.
Well, I have to admit, you perked up my ears when, you know, you say, well, what women really talk about in a room. And I have to admit that it would be very interesting to be a fly in the wall and hear some women talk about a number of their issues.
Can you suggest some ways that women might get together with other women locally to have these kinds of discussions?
Well, one thing is I have done a few talks for all women's groups. And whether it's for a financial services firm, whether it's for, in one case it was a bank, whether it was for, at one point, a... I'm trying to think of where else I have done just all women's group, sort of a church setting mm-hmm. where they had hired me to talk as well, and just sort of discussing all of these things, again, holistically, but I do have to say money comes up a lot. And women are often the first to say, I mean, some do certainly pay all the bills and do all of that, but when it comes to things like investing, when it comes to things like that long-term planning, they feel uncertain. I mean, it would be like me. If I cut myself and I wanted to suture myself, I would feel totally out of my realm. I would go to a professional to do that. And a lot of women, I think, maybe that it's out of their ballpark as far as financially to get help doing that sort of thing. So I think to let people know it is possible wherever you are, you can get help if you need it. You can get advice. There's so many books. There's so many things on the Internet. There are people such as yourselves, able, willing, qualified to give that sort of advice. They need to avail themselves of it. A frequent thing I hear is they're just not interested, however. They're not. They know they should be. They know it's important, they know, but it's sort of the thing, I'm going to get around to that later. I'm not going to worry about it now. Right now I'm consumed with my job, I'm consumed with my children, I'm consumed with day-to-day life. And thinking ahead out there 10, 20 years is difficult for many people. And that's why I think if you talk about this lifestyle kind of planning instead of retirement, it does make it a little more immediate. I'm sort of into this whole area now of behavioral economics, and one of the big terms in there is called future discounting. We kind of make decisions in the here and now, and psychologists call us being in a hot state, making a decision, whereas things way out in the distance, we might say, oh, yeah, we're going to do that, we're going to do that, but when it comes right down to it, we often pick, and this applies to men as well as women, what is the most pleasurable at the moment? They did this classic study, and they asked people, what do you want delivered to you 1 week from now? We can either deliver nice, fresh, crisp, delicious, healthy apples to you, or some decadent chocolate. And I know chocolate can be good for you. Let's say this is the bad chocolate. So when people were asked, what do you pick to be delivered a week from now? The great majority, over 70%, said, oh, send me the apples. But when those researchers came in and they had an apple in one hand and they had the great chocolate in the other and said, pick one, you can have one now, then the same percentage, over 70, mm-hmm. took the chocolate then. And I think that all of these psychological things play so much into that decision-making. We tend to think in the here and now, and thinking out 10, 20, 30 years is a difficult thing, and we have to become more now-oriented.
Well, speaking of being now-oriented, let's take a quick break. And if you have comment or a question for Jim or Jan, call the KQV studios at 412-333-9385.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
And welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. I'm David Baer here with Jim Lang and Jan Cullinane, author of The Single Woman's Guide to Retirement. Listeners, you can join the conversation by calling KQV at 412-333-9385. And speaking of that, we actually do have a listener's question now that's been emailed in from Carol. So I'm going to just read it on Carol's behalf, and Jan maybe will be able to help her. Her question is, let's say that a woman had financial accounts in joint ownership with her husband, and he died. Can you discuss the pros and cons of her replacing her deceased husband's name with the child's on her financial accounts, not as a beneficiary, but as an owner?
Jan, I'll let you
go
first.
I'm going to hand that one to you, Jim.
All right. Well, then I'll take it. Absolutely not, unless there's a lot of money around. Here's the problem. So let's say that you're the surviving spouse, and let's assume for discussion's sake that the total estate is less than $1 million, and let's assume that that safe withdrawal rate, even on a 30-year retirement, is about 4%. We've had a bunch of calls on the safe withdrawal rate. So that's only $40,000, and that's if you have $1 million. Now let's say that you make what is potentially a big mistake in you add one or a combination of your children's name on that account. And let's say one of your children have a problem. If they die, then you have to pay inheritance tax on your own money. Much more common is they will have a creditor problem, and it is possible that some of that money will be lost to creditors. And by the way, who is the most likely creditor? Their future ex-husband or wife. So if that person who the caller said, hey, should I put my son or my daughter on? Well, if they do that and then their son or daughter gets a divorce, then the divorcing party or the spouse of the child of the person who just put their child's name on the account is subject to significant reduction. I am not a fan of doing joint name. Now, maybe later on, let's say you have a situation where costs are pretty well known and you're not looking at a 30-year life expectancy, you're looking at a 5-year life expectancy, and the child's the primary caretaker and caregiver. Though that might be different, but in general, I am not a big fan of putting joint names on a surviving spouse's accounts. And one of the things that concerns me is I think that, and particularly this goes for advisors, you have to consider who your client is. When I'm in there with a husband and a wife, the husband and the wife are my client, not just the supposed decision maker that might be the husband. So that's why I was so unhappy with this situation with the single pension and reduced Social Security. I would say the same thing here. I have to represent the spouse, not the child. The child's not coming in. The child's not paying the fee. I would say keep it in your own name.
And you know, just to add to that, I think a lot of women were grown up and socialized to be selfless and giving, and we're thinking of our children. You know, I talk to a lot of women who even they need to really pay themselves first and take care of themselves first. They may want to, say, for example, put their grandchildren through college. But, you know, their grandchildren are going to have a much longer horizon, and they need to think about themselves first. And really, it's doing the best for your children because you then don't want to become a drain on them. You want to be self-sufficient. So I think some of that psychology often will play into feeling like that, you know, you want to take care of everybody, and you really have to put yourself first.
Well, I agree with that. And Jonathan Clemens always says, you can borrow money for college, but you can't borrow money for your retirement. And I do know that whether it's the nurturing nature or for whatever reason, women, in my opinion, often are interested in giving or lending or helping their kids out. And that's great if you have more than enough money. I'm all for making gifts and helping out your kids and your grandkids if you can afford it. But if you can't afford it, then maybe your kid had, you know, they don't get to go to the Ivy League school. They have to go to Pitt or Penn State, or they have, or maybe even somewhere that's even less expensive, or they have to go out and get loans, summer jobs, or things like that, because it's a real problem. And I think that women have to be, and men, but I think women have to be very cognizant of the fact that, hey, they might be around with a certain amount of resources, X dollars, and I think we have a call coming up with that, with X dollars and maybe X income for Social Security, and maybe there isn't enough to adequately provide for them and do the gifting and family support that they might want to do.
Well, actually, we do have another question, and this one is from a listener, Marge in Squirrel Hill. Is Marge there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Would you want to ask your question?
Oh, yes. So my question deals with how do you actually sort of come up with some numbers about how much a good retirement fund should be? I'm going to get Social Security. I've worked all my life. I'm a single woman. I live alone. And so I'm just trying to come up with some tools to figure out what number that is that I need to retire.
Oh, okay. I'm going to repeat the question because we had a little bit of a static or sound issues. So basically the problem is, so Marge from Squirrel Hill saying, how much money do I need as a single woman living alone to retire? And again, I'm happy to take that one, but I'll also give it to you if you want, Jan, or maybe both of us can chime in. Do you want me to start?
Okay,
or would you...
let me give a couple general things,
sure.
And then if you want to add in, that would be great. There's certainly many online tools that you can use. There's a very easy one called the Ballpark Estimator. You can put that into your search engine on the computer, and it will pop up. It'll give you some idea. AARP has a great retirement calculator, and I'm not just saying that because the book is with AARP, but it is a good one. But when you say, how much do I need, there's so many variables there. One thing I advocate is thinking about where you presently live. Is it something where do you have all the pieces in place? Do you have your social support? Do you have good medical care where you are? Do you have something that as you age, you're going to be able to age in your home? Do you have universal design features incorporated into your home? If you take a look and you're single and you're looking as to where you live now, is there somewhere you could move in the vicinity and, say, get some equity out of your house, move somewhere else that's less expensive and make your money last longer? Close to half of mature women in an AARP survey said they were willing to have a non-romantic roommate. That would be a way to make your money perhaps last as long as you do. Staying healthy is another way. So many diseases, so many of our health care costs go to lifestyle issues. So if you're looking for, you know, a magic number, there certainly are lots of ways to estimate. Some are a multiple of your income now that you can come up with a number. But another way is to look very differently at it and say, well, what kind of changes could I make? Are you living below your means now? You know, and take a look at those sorts of things also and see, can I live if money is tight? One woman in my book gave a fabulous example. She goes from place to place and volunteers where they pay for her lodging, pay for her food. She just has to get there. In between these stints, she actually stays with her son and daughter-in-law in a bedroom in between. But basically, she is living on her Social Security alone, getting her around. So there are a lot of creative ways where you may want to maintain the same lifestyle you have now. But if not, there's some other things you can do to adjust if you feel you're not going to have enough money.
Well, I also have my own viewpoint on that, and I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but planning to live with your son and daughter-in-law and then at the at the mercy of people who hire you doesn't sound like, I mean, it sounds like it's working for her, and that's great. The other thing that you mentioned with the calculators, I think the calculators are fine. The problem, I think, with sometimes the calculators is people don't know what's behind the calculators. So I'm going to try to give a kind of a quantitative piece of advice in a, let's say, a more mathematical way of looking at it. I think that it really depends on how much money you need to spend. And let's use a concrete example. Let's assume that your normal expenses are somewhere around $35,000 a year, but including taxes. But even if they are $35,000 a year, every once in a while you're going to have years where you need to spend more. If you own a house, at some point you're going to have a roof problem, you're going to have a furnace problem. even if you don't, you have, at some point you're going to need a new car. There might be a family expense. So, plus I always want to be conservative, so I'll think, okay, let's say we need $40,000. And let's assume for discussion's sake that Social Security is $20,000. So now we need $20,000 from the portfolio. All right, so the way you would say, and let's just use the old rule of thumb, 4% safe withdrawal rate on a 30-year retirement. So if you had a $500,000 in portfolio, and you multiplied that times 4%, that's $20,000. So you get $20,000 from your portfolio and $20,000 from Social Security, and you can make it on for the $40,000. But if you only have $225,000 and you're 64 years old and you're thinking about whether you should retire, the answer is no, you better keep working. I don't know if that sounds fair or not, but I think that, again, and I like the way that you call it not retirement planning but lifetime planning, I think that both men and women, but especially women, have to think about this kind of thing. And I actually taught a course for, it was for divorce attorneys, and it was for divorce over 50. And the bar association that hired me actually had pre-done a course, and I was just supposed to teach that course. And it was all kinds of things that I didn't think were very relevant, like taking money out of an IRA before 55 or before 59 and a half. The way I look at it, if you're taking money out of an IRA before 59 and a half, you're broke at 70. And I wanted to look at other issues like, well, does it make sense for a woman to try to get the house and her husband to retain the 401k? And I was arguing, no, it's the opposite. I want the spouse, particularly the non-working spouse, to get the liquid assets. And I think that you have to think about these things. My approach, of course, is a quantitative approach, a running the numbers type approach. But I think that Jan, some of your issues were, well, maybe you don't need to maintain your lifestyle. Maybe you can find alternative accommodation. Maybe, you know, whether it's with a roommate. I know somebody is going down to Costa Rica to retire because they can retire on less money. So it is an individual thing.
Right. And by all means, you know, looking at what you need now, figuring out your expenses, like you say, replacing the roof, replacing the refrigerator, doing all that, calculating that, what are you going to need to live? That those are all straightforward. That's the excellent advice. You can come out, you can project a number and come out with it. But it's just sometimes a way of thinking a little differently, because two people can live more cheaply than one. And I know of at least four instances where two sisters are living together, their spouses have passed away, or people move somewhere. Builders are now looking more, you know, single women are the second largest group of homeowners, and builders are aware of this and are building more women-centric home, and they're doing often having two masters, for example, knowing that, hey, you might bring your social support group with you, and you could have two people living in a home with universal design, and you can share those expenses. So it's not in place of, it's just another way of thinking, well, what are some alternative ways if I'm willing to consider them? The woman who volunteers, that would not be for me. I wouldn't be living with my daughter and son-in-law in between stints. But like you said, for her, She thought that was a great way to be able to live on minimal money. She was barely there with her son and thought it was just a kind of an ingenious way of doing things.
And having different experiences.
Yeah. And
another thing.
And the other thing that I think is interesting, people do have interesting alternative lifestyles. I have some clients, they're actually three women, in their own words, they, quote, got rid of their husbands, as if it was like a pest or a disease that you have to get rid of. And now they have several residences and that they, some of them own it together and some of them own it separately, but they're basically living together, vacationing together, sharing their lives in what I believe to be a non-sexual relationship and having a good time. And frankly, they are enjoying some of the economies of scale of living with other people.
And, you know, there's this whole trend of co-housing now where you do share. You have a common house, for example, where you can share meals. You still have your own individual home, but there's joint decision-making. People come up with the rules themselves. They run their little community on their own. And this is a great thing for social support because I think that's something that we have to look at, not only the finances, but also social support. I mean, if we were going to look at what makes a successful retirement, besides having enough money, one of the biggest things is you have to have that social support. Who's going to be taking care of you? Now, again, maybe if you're married, chances are you're going to outlive your spouse, but you need to think about those issues down the line as well. So a lot of people have chosen these co-housing communities. There are hundreds of them popping up all over the United States where you live in a group, you have shared values, shared decision-making, and that idea is you've got that social support right there. Because where you're living now, you might find people are starting to leave, moving away, perhaps passing away. And so where are you going to get that social support? You might have it now, but again, thinking into 10, 20, 30 years from now, where is it going to come from?
And let's say, I mean, maybe you might have children. I know, for example, that my mom, who actually just passed about a year ago, somebody in the family, whether it was my brother or myself or even my wife, but somebody saw her just about every day. And frankly, we wanted her living close so we could get to see her easily. It would not have been great if she had, you know, moved away an hour away or something like that. On the other hand, if we weren't around, one of these arrangements might have been very appropriate.
Well, yeah, and there are a lot of possibilities, and let's talk about them after we come back from this next break.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
And welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. I'm Dave Baer with Jim Lang and Jan Cullen. And Jan, before we get back to the topics, we did want to ask about one thing. We noticed in the your bio material, it says that you can speak backwards fluently. What exactly is that all about?
Lu Einak Nesitsa Tau Taistinawas. And that's it. I just said, well, I can, and this is how it sounds. So if I said, I'm able to take a sentence, and if you read it forward, like this is the Jim Lang Money Hour, uh-huh, for example, I would say this, sit, the, et, Jim, Mij, Lang, Egnal, Money, Yanam, Hour, Ruah. So I take each word, and I'm able to transpose it in my mind, and I can talk backwards as easily, forward as backward. So it's a very odd ability. Found out I could do it when I was a kid. Try to have my 15 minutes of fame with it from David Letterman's Stupid Human Tricks and a few other, and Todd being on the Tyra Banks show, but but I'm here doing retirement.
You're doing it.
We're giving you 1 minute of fame.
Okay, thanks
for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right, and in case we get cut off because we are approaching the end, the book is AARP's Single Women's Guide to Retirement by Jan Cullinane, C-U-L-L-I-N-A-N-E. Jan, you earlier alluded that you are a student or an expert in behavioral economics. And I can attest, both things that I've read and seen in practice, that there are certain differences between men and women investors. And one area where women actually exceed men and do better as investors is because they tend to take more time in arriving at a particular investment or even an investment strategy. They will do more, a higher degree of due diligence. I know for us, getting a single woman or a widow on board is usually, frankly, more work and more time and has a higher trust threshold than maybe a couple or a single man. But then once they're there, then it's done. So they are more thoughtful in making decisions. But once there, they don't buy and sell and buy and sell and do all types of things that a lot of men do that end up actually hurting them. So that's one difference that I have noticed. The other,
and I like how you said that. You said that in a very positive way, because a lot of times it said women are more, you know, risk averse. But I like the way you said it. And women do tend to ask a lot more questions. Now, men, whether they don't because they feel they'll look more foolish or not as well schooled in it, is sort of an interesting thing. And I think the other thing, again, is the socialization, that growing up, for example, one expert, Tahira Hira, who's at Iowa State University, has found that, you know, as women grow up, they're taught more about budgeting and saving, not that that's a bad thing, than really more learning about stocks and bonds and estate planning that men may be exposed to more. So I think you actually hit that on the head, that women do have a different approach to it, more thoughtful, more questions, taking their time more. You'll have to invest a little more time in them, no pun intended, but it's certainly well worth it.
And the other thing is, they're not necessarily trying to, quote, win. They're not trying to do better than their neighbor. They're not necessarily trying to beat the market. And this might sound a little bit self-serving, but when we do workshops for index investing, which basically have outperformed active managers by, in at least one study, net 97% of the index advisors outperform the active advisors. So you're not saying, okay, I'm going to try to beat the market, I'm going to be the market. And I think some of these strategies are intuitively preferred by women, where the man might say, oh, I want to be with the hottest manager. And then when that doesn't work out, they change, and then they go to somebody else. And when that doesn't work out, they change, or they maybe even worse yet, make some of these investment decisions on their own, where sometimes the woman investor is more thoughtful, more cautious about going in, but once they decide on a strategy, and again, I'm obviously an advocate of the index strategy, and I would say that for a man or a woman, but particularly if you didn't have the problem of an ego trying to beat the market, so to speak, that this is really a very good way to go, and then not keep changing ships each time the wind blows.
You're absolutely right, and one study even showed, you know, when they surveyed women, that 4 out of 5 really wanted more the safety and security of income for life. Rather than, and they weren't as concerned about how the market is performing, to your point, you know, the index funds, they're really looking for some security.
Well, I think that's important. And there are some financial products, but I think both men and women have to be a little bit careful about those that sometimes supply a lifetime income. Again, I tend to favor the low cost, low or no commission. And rather you pay the money manager a fee rather than a commission. But I think sometimes the index funds and something that is geared towards lasting for your entire life and not trying to hit the home run, but just making sure that there is sufficient money to maintain lifestyle is very important. And sometimes men are a little bit riskier by nature.
Absolutely.
So there really are behavioral differences. You know, we only have actually a couple minutes left, and there's a couple things that I did want to get to. I think that you have a couple, let's say, tips for women to prepare for retirement, and then things that they can do once they are retired. So if you could perhaps give us a few insights on a couple things women can do to prepare for retirement and some of the things they could do to maximize their income when they are retired.
Well, one thing I think as far as preparing for retirement, I always like to say people should ask themselves these three questions if they're even thinking about retiring, asking themselves, do I have enough? Have I had enough? And do I have enough to do? So, you know, do I have enough? Obviously is the money aspect. Have I had enough? Are you ready to move on to explore new areas, whatever they might be, and leave what you're currently doing? And do you have enough to do? Because think about it, even if you have the money, you have 168 hours a week that you have to meaningfully use. So it's important to make sure you have something you're retiring to and not from. Another point I'd say would be negotiation. If you have not negotiated your very first salary, and research has shown this, that by the time you have gone through your career, you would have about $500,000 less that you would have earned over that time than somebody who had negotiated a first salary. When you think about that from the get-go, it makes a huge difference. Now, maybe it's you're nearing the end of your working career, so that's not going to apply to you, but if you have children or grandchildren, I'd say that that's an important thing women need to do. You know, they've done surveys, and women see negotiating as more like going to the dentist, and men compare it to a baseball game. So a lot of that, again, talk about behavior and what's in your mind. It's an attitude and how we approach it. So that's something I think that's important, because it can be learned, negotiations.
Well, as a matter of fact, there is a very good book. It happens to be by one of my clients, and it's called Women Don't Ask.
By
I think it's Linda Babcock.
Linda Babcock.
Yeah.
That's the research I'm citing about not negotiating the first salary.
Right.
It's a terrific book.
Right. So I think one of her issues is it's not necessarily sex discrimination that women get paid less. It's because they don't ask, they don't fight for themselves, so they just make less. And her big thing is, well, you have to negotiate for some of these things, and I just hope that my wife nor any of my employees are listening to this.
And if you actually saw Sheryl Sandberg on 60 Minutes doing her interview,
Lean In.
You know, the woman who's written that fabulous book, Lean In, and when she was offered the job with Facebook, she was ready to take the salary. And it was her husband who said, and here's this high-powered woman, he said, you can't take that salary. You have to negotiate. Nobody would take the first salary that was offered you at your position. And she said, oh, really? And that was very enlightening to me, because this woman's got her degrees from Harvard, and yet here she is in the same position that most of us are in. It's difficult to do that.
Yeah, and I'm being a little bit facetious with my wife and my employees, but I think it really is important that women be cognizant of this in the workplace. The other thing that I will say about retirement, I'm going to add one other issue. If somebody is working, and then let's say that they want to replicate their income, I actually think they have to count on spending more in retirement. Because if somebody is a diligent worker, and they're spending at least 40 hours, sometimes 40, 50, 60 hours a week at their job, one of the reasons they're not spending more is because they're working all the time. So if they are planning to retire, it is very possible, whether it's because of travel or other hobbies, interests, etc., that they should plan on needing more money.
If they're not, yes, the working, you're right. You're occupying 40 or 50 hours a week. That's time you're not taking these exotic vacations and doing all these things.
Anyway,
absolutely.
Anyway, it has been a pleasure. The book is AARP's Single Woman Guide to Retirement.
Well, and I want to say thanks to Jan Cullinane, author, as Jim said, of The Single Woman's Guide to Retirement, for joining us tonight. You can reach her directly through her website, jancullinane.com.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Check out the show archives and listen on demand anytime at retiresecure.com. KQV listeners can receive free tickets to Jim Lang's Pittsburgh area workshops and more. Call the Lang Financial Group at 412-521-2732. That's 412-521-2732. And reserve your seats and meet Jim Lang in person. Again, that's 412-521-2732.